Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Brian Chan, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing trout lakes. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Brian a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Brian Chan about fly fishing trout lakes. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, and the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their work. For more information, go to the Federation website at www.fedflyfishers.org. That's www.fedflyfishers.org. Before we introduce Brian, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win in our drawing tonight. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Brian's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. And thanks to Brian, we'll be giving away a copy of his DVD titled Expert Techniques for Stillwater Fly Fishing with Brian Chan. Here's how you can win that DVD tonight. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question's going to be about something that Brian and I talk about during the show. You must submit your answer, along with your name and your location, using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll win Brian's DVD. Brian Chan has been an avid stillwater fly fisher and fly tyer for over 35 years. He's a professional fisheries biologist who for the past 30 years managed small lake recreational fisheries as well as promoting and marketing freshwater fishing in the province of British Columbia. Brian is also a fly fishing author, video producer, lecturer, and angling guide. Some of his more recent works include the books Morris and Chan on Fly Fishing Trout Lakes, Stillwater Solution Recipes, 30 Proven Patterns by Brian Chan and Phil Raleigh, and the DVD Expert Techniques for Stillwater Fly Fishing. He is also a regular contributor to several fly fishing magazines publications. Brian is a regular guest on several TV shows and is co-host of the new Fly Fisher Show. Brian's favorite fishing haunts are the many trout lakes around his home city of Kamloops, but he often can be found wading rivers in other provinces and states, as well as making forays into the Northwest Territories and the Yukon for big lake trout and pike. Brian has a number of professional fly fishing industry affiliations, including Sage, Mustad, Rio, Islander, Superfly, and Outcast Sporting Gear. Brian, thanks for joining us, and welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thanks, Roger. I'm about a week late, but we finally made it.
Yeah, well, everybody's been anxiously awaiting, and we're all sorry you were ill and poor timing, but what can you do about it, right?
That's right.
That's right, yeah. So happens to all of us at one point in time or another. And, hey, we're just glad to have you. And, you know, the thing is it just gave people extra week to come up with more questions for us. So we're, thanks to our listeners, we're not lacking for questions at all tonight. And folks, thanks. That's what makes the show great, is that you do submit all those questions, and we love to have them, and we've got a bunch of them tonight. And we'll do our best to get through as many of them as possible. What we're going to cover, we're going to talk about lakes first, and then we'll move into fish. We had some questions about fish in the lakes, and then food and flies. We'll move on then into tactics, presentations, equipment, and things like that. We've got a load of questions. Forgive me if I group your question in with a bunch of others, because we do have some repetitive questions, and so we'll kind of lump some together. Try to give everybody as much credit as I can as we go, but just realize that we do have to do that at times. Okay, let's get started. Well, first of all, Brian, not all of us know, what does a fisheries biologist, what is one, and what does one do?
Well, certainly in my case, being a professional fish biologist, my career was spent managing recreational trout fisheries. And so part of that is obviously setting regulations, defining and managing to specific regulations and producing certain types of fisheries versus, you know, a family fishery versus a quality fishery. Also do a lot of work in habitat protection, inventory work as well. And believe it or not, a lot of a fisheries biologist's time in this day and age is spent dealing with questions from the public and social issues, management issues based on social sciences such as, you know, boating restrictions, regulation type things like that. And so it's basically quite a mishmash of different activities that a well-rounded biologist encounters during their career.
Yeah, sounds like, you know, we kind of picture, well, maybe somebody out collecting samples in the lake and going back to the lab, but it sounds like it involves a lot more than that, especially when you start dealing with people. and that's many times the joy and also the pain of work. So, well, good. So in that process, you would maybe determine what the put and take limits are and things like that, and the health of the fish as well. And things.
Yep, we certainly do, you know, develop management plans for various lakes within a particular area. And so that's stocking rates and then putting the other regulations on there to match the type of fishery you're trying to manage towards.
Now, up in British Columbia, you have a lot of lakes and a lot of water to cover. Are all of them managed, or is it just more the ones that are readily accessible?
I mean, well, there's about 20,000 lakes in the province of British Columbia, and I would hazard a guess that the province probably actively manages about 5,000 of them, meaning there's lake-specific regulations on 5,000 specific water bodies. And the remaining 15,000 are, you know, it's a big province, and a lot of it's quite remote, so they're kind of way out there waiting to be discovered, so to speak.
Right, right. And so many of them are just wild and take care
Absolutely.
Of themselves, basically.
The majority of freshwater fishing opportunities in the province are based on wild populations of fish, be them trout or char or kokanee, for instance. And trout would include steelhead, rainbow trout, west slope cutthroat trout, coastal cutthroat, things like that.
Okay, okay. Well, we've got several questions here. One from Gary, Olympic Peninsula, Steve, Bruno in Westminster, Frank Wood in Norwalk, California, Bob in Alberta, all asking about the turnover of lakes and whether it be spring, fall, whatever. So could you kind of run over the turnover, explain what it is and how it affects us as fly fishers?
Sure. I think it's best, Roger, just to back up a couple steps. So this is a very common question, and it's a very often misunderstood concept by anglers, and it's an important concept for anglers to understand. The first thing we need to know is that there are three different types of lakes that you talk about. There's eutrophic lakes, mesotrophic lakes, and oligotrophic lakes. The lakes that we're talking about, I'm talking about, or the lakes that we typically want to fish for trout are eutrophic lakes. And they are defined as the being quite shallow. Usually have intermittent or no inlets or outlets. That means they have a very low flushing rate, not a lot of water mixes through them. There's lots of littoral or shoal area, shallow water area, so there's good plant growth, and relatively nutrient-rich in terms of the basins that they lay in. The soils and the geology around there makes them nutrient-rich so that they grow insects and other food sources of fish. Mesotrophic lakes are deeper lakes, quite a bit larger, typically have streams or small rivers running in and out of them, so there's a high flushing rate, meaning the water is replaced on a regular basis. These are less productive than a eutrophic lake, and obviously, once we get into mesotrophic lakes, then we start looking at different species composition of fish as well. And then the most unproductive lakes are called oligotrophic lakes, and these are the big ocean-type lakes, like in British Columbia, as an example, like Shuswap Lake or Quesnel Lake, Okanagan Lake. These are deep lakes, typically minimal shoal or littoral zone areas, big rivers coming in and out of them, extremely high flushing rates, so the nutrients don't stay long in the lake. And again, different species composition of fish. The eutrophic lakes are the trout lakes. These are the ones that we want to concentrate on, and you can have eutrophic lakes in British Columbia, right across Canada, right across the northern states, certainly in the southern states. So these are shallow lakes, typically less maximum depth, less than 50 feet, extensive shoal or shallow areas of water less than about 20 feet in depth, and minimal flushing. So there may be small tributary inlets and outlets. The best fishing lakes, though, end up being those lakes that are landlocked, no inlets, no outlets, so the residence time of the water is, well, it's there all the time, and they're like great big compost box. So
I would just, you know, think that, gosh, fresh water in the lake would be good, but...
It does have its place.
Yeah.
So in eutrophic lakes, they typically have a spring and fall turnover, and then they also stratify in the summer months. So what happens on a typical seasonal change? So they have spring, summer, fall, winter, just like we endure in the Pacific Northwest. We're in the wintertime right now. So why don't we just take it from wintertime? So right now it's the dead of winter in much of the northern climate of North America anyways. Our lakes are frozen, and there's a covering of ice and then snow on top of those lakes. So what's happening right now under the ice is that because there's no photosynthesis occurring, there's no green plant growth occurring, and so there's no new oxygen being inputted into the lake. So the fish that are in the lakes right now are surviving on what oxygen was in that lake the day the ice formed on the water body. If the winter is extremely long, we could eventually not have enough oxygen in that lake to support fish life through the entire winter months. And what will happen is you'll get a winter kill where the fish will actually die right through in the midwinter months. Other than that, they'll often, if there's enough oxygen, they'll make it right until ice off and everybody's happy. Quite often, though, you'll get a partial kill where kill right at ice off, where the fish have almost made it right through to the end of ice off, but they just succumb at the very last couple weeks prior to the ice coming off. So the day the ice comes off a lake, so our fish in the lake have made it. The day the ice comes off a lake, the water doesn't instantly mix. And if you looked at a cross-sectional view of the water column and looked at the oxygen levels, you would see that the oxygen levels would be the highest at the surface and the lowest at the bottom of the lake. And that's a result of continual decomposition that occurred all winter months and the slow deterioration of oxygen levels. And the last remaining oxygen levels are just under the ice. So the day the ice comes off the lake, there's typically more oxygen high in the water column than low in the water column. The day the ice comes off the lake, the water temperature is not uniform from top to bottom. The water will be warmer at the bottom and colder at the surface. It's warmer at the bottom because of anaerobic decomposition occurring during the winter months, which is decomposing the plant vegetation, and one of the byproducts is heat. It's colder at the surface because the ice has just come off. So the day the ice comes off, water doesn't mix or turn over. Water doesn't like to mix unless it's uniform temperature. And the water, when it reaches 39 degrees Fahrenheit or 4 degrees Celsius, is the most dense And so when the entire water column warms up, so the surface temperatures warm up to 39 and similar to the bottom temperatures, the surface waters will sink and they'll mix with the bottom water, the deeper parts. You add wind and the entire water column turns over. And that's what our spring turnover is. So add ice off. And for the first 2 weeks after ice off, the water in a lake could be crystal clear, and you can actually have some pretty good fishing right at ice off. Surface temperatures warm up, similar to the bottom temperatures. We get a heavy wind, and the lake turns over. The energy of the wind, combined with the uniform densities of the water, make a mixing action to occur, and what was a clear lake will now become quite turbid. This is called spring turnover. At the same time, remembering that the oxygen at ice off is also quite a bit, is higher at the surface and less concentrated at the bottom. So when a lake turns over in the spring, that oxygenated water in the upper layers mix with the less oxygenated water in the lower layers, and that causes a very rapid drop in oxygen levels in the entire lake. That combined with the upwelling of hydrogen sulfide and methane gases, because of the turnover event, makes the fish very uncomfortable and they go off the feed. Worst case scenario, if there's not enough oxygen to go around when those upper oxygenated layers mix with the deeper unoxygenated layers, you'll get what we call a spring kill, where the fish die 2 weeks after the lake has come off. And that is not that common, but I've seen it happen several times, certainly in my career on lakes, where I've actually been on a lake and it's been a week and a half after ice off. The lake is mixing, and we're seeing dead fish, we're seeing live fish beaching themselves on shore. They're literally suffocating. So it's a pretty violent death. But normally, spring turnover occurs, the water's turbid for 3 to 5 days, then she clears up, settles out. Now the entire water column from top to bottom is totally saturated with oxygen. Water temperatures throughout the water column are starting to warm up. Spring air temperatures, first bugs of the season start to come off, first chironomid hatches, and everybody's happy. That's spring turnover. So you need to understand when that's happening, particularly if you had great fishing right after ice off, go back to a week later with all your buddies, and you come back to a lake that's filthy, lots of debris in the water, you know that lake is turning over, you don't want to fish there. You have two options. You go down lower in elevation to catch a lake that's already turned over, or you go higher in elevation to catch a lake that hasn't turned over. Then we move from spring turnover into, we get that nice spring, early summer season where we have great fishing, all the great bug hatches. Water temperatures warm up in the summer, and the energy of the sun will only penetrate down so far into the water column. That's called the epilimnetic layer of the water. That's the upper layers of water. So the water temperatures, water will get warmed down to about 6-7 meters, 23, 24, 25 feet in depth, depending on the clarity of the water. Below that, the water remains quite cool. And in many eutrophic lakes, they will develop what we call a thermocline, which is an invisible barrier that forms like a sheet of plastic across the lake down at that 5 to 7, 8 meter depth where the maximum energy of sunlight extends to. And below that thermocline, the water's quite cool. It's a rapid drop in temperature. Above, it's quite warm. That thermocline acts as a barrier to mixing. So the wind can blow and blow all it wants, but it won't mix the water below the thermocline on a well-established thermocline. And so that has implications on where food gathers in a lake, where zooplankton gathers, where the fish can swim, where they can't swim, because there may not be enough oxygen. So in the most eutrophic lakes, certainly in British Columbia, in western states, in the Pacific Northwest, in Colorado, Idaho, Washington, Oregon, certainly, and those very, very productive trout lakes, quite often, there will not be a lot of oxygen below the thermocline. And in the worst case scenarios, there's not enough oxygen to support trout because they need cool water, but they also need oxygen. And the reason why there isn't a lot of oxygen below the thermocline is because there's not a lot of mixing going. There's no mixing going on below the thermocline because of its very resistance to mixing. So in the normal situation, this thermocline develops, but there's still lots of oxygen below it. But you have to remember that in some of the very productive lakes, it can be a barrier to the mixing of oxygen, and it can actually force fish from living in the deeper parts of the lake. We've now made it through the summer months. Air temperatures are cooling down. Water temperatures are cooling down. water temperatures at the surface are cooling down so that they, by late fall, become similar to the temperatures at the bottom of the lake. And once they get again close to 39 degrees Fahrenheit or 4 degrees centigrade, the entire water column will mix again. Surface waters will sink to the bottom, and a heavy wind will literally, like a washing machine, bring the bottom water up to the surface. Surface water will get pushed to the bottom. This is Mother Nature's way of supersaturating the lake and getting it prepared for a long winter. So turnover supercharges the lake with oxygen. It's critical that it happens on these eutrophic lakes. It sets it up for winter so that when the first ice comes onto the lake, the entire water column is saturated from top to bottom. And now we're back into the winter months where we're now living off what oxygen was supercharged into the water prior to ice on. So that kind of completes the entire life of a lake in terms of changes in water chemistry. I know I covered a lot of information there, but it's pretty important to understand that.
No, I think you did an excellent job of describing the whole scenario. One question about the thermocline. You said it could or couldn't have, or may or may not have, oxygen below the thermocline layer there or level.
Yeah.
So the fish move up out of the deep if the oxygen level drops?
That's right. You know, one of our best tools on a lake is a depth sounder or a fish finder, and we will mark thermoclines on your fish finder because the zooplankton will stack up along the thermocline, and the fish during the day will sit just above the thermocline where the water's cool and well oxygenated. But below it, there may not be a lot of fish, and that's the reason being is there may not be that much oxygen there.
So keeping that in mind, you could be fishing too deep if you're not catching anything. And
exactly.
Again, trying to find where they are in the water column is always the challenge. But
that's what it's all about. And exactly, you could, on some lakes, you could be fishing in water that's devoid of trout. In the
right, right. At below that level, sure.
Yep.
Well, we need to take a quick break, Brian, but when we come back, we'll talk with you more about fly fishing trout lakes.
Perfect.
Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walkweight and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. Located conveniently on US 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. And for more information, you can visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's www.royalgorgeanglers.com, or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Brian Chan about fly fishing trout lakes. If you'd like to ask Brian a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, before we dive back in, Brian, tell us a bit about, you know, what's up with you in the fly fishing world. What are you up to? Are you writing any books, doing any shows, speaking? Tell us what's up in your world.
Well, I actually retired this past June, in June of 09. And have moved on, transitioning into more fly fishing things, things I've always wanted to do more of after retirement. I'm still keeping my hand in fisheries biology, doing some contract work for the Freshwater Fish Society of British Columbia. But I've branched out into doing a bit more writing, and I did start a fly fishing guiding service a couple of years ago, so I've been expanding that a bit. Doing more TV shows and more seminars at trade shows as well as for clubs and things like that. And also have a to-do list at home that I'm supposed to be working on.
Who made that to-do list?
It wasn't me.
Well, good for you. Good for you. Do you have a website that people can go to find out what you're up to?
Yeah, absolutely. It's riseformflyfishing.com.
Riseform as in R-I-S-E-F-O-R-M. Fishing.com?
Yep, riseformflyfishing.com.
Oh, fly fishing. Okay, riseformflyfishing.com. Good.
You betcha.
Good. Terrific. Well, you writing, so maybe we'll see another book down the road sometime.
Yeah, I've got to stay off the water long enough to do it, though.
Yeah, it takes a lot of time, that's for sure, to do the writing.
You betcha.
Yeah. Well, good. Well, back into our questions here. And this is an interesting question from Bob in Lac du Flambeau, Wisconsin. And I know where that is. I did some muskie and pike fishing up in that area. But he says he's got some spring ponds up there where he observes schools of native brook trout doing laps around the pond, he says, presumably looking for food. He says these spring ponds do not support mayflies or caddis hatches, midge scuds, or anything, evidently. And they've got, you know, some complex water temperatures and so forth. He says they're seldom more than 8 to 10 feet deep max. And he's wondering if these are the type of ponds that would turn over. And maybe you could answer that question.
Yeah, typically on a small spring-fed pond, they would not go through the typical scenario that I just described, simply because that water that's coming in through the springs is a constant temperature and usually quite productive water, and it negates any of those changes that usually go through a typical lake that undergoes considerable water or changes in water temperature. The fish, brook trout in general, like our schooling fish, and they do like to follow each other around. They do that typically a lot more in the fall when they develop, when they sexually mature and they're looking for areas, gravelly areas in that particular case, to shore spawn, things like that.
Okay. Now, when you say a piece of water this small probably wouldn't turn over, is there a kind of a minimum size that a lake needs to be to take on that kind of activity?
I think size-wise, it just in generality, you probably need to be, you know, 5 to 6 acres and larger for the effects of these temperature fluctuations and the use of wind to make these things happen.
Okay. Another question, Jack Simpson up in British Columbia asked, how does one readily identify alkaline or acidic lakes, and what are the predominant food sources for trout in both of them?
Yeah, so obviously in this part of the country, the alkaline lakes are lakes higher than with a pH greater than 7 and preferably in the 8 to 8.7 range are the most nutrient-rich, and they're going to have the most diversity in aquatic invertebrates or food sources for trout. And the way you biologically, just by looking at lake, you can tell where it's acidic or neutral or alkaline, is often by the plants that you see in the lake, the aquatic vegetation in the lake. So if the lake you're looking at is the shoreline or shoal area is covered in lily pads with pink flowers and maybe some pondweed, potamogeton, then you know that water is going to be neutral to acidic in its pH. And it probably would have tannic or tea-stained water coloration to it as well. Whereas an alkaline lake will often be clear in color. The common aquatic vegetation you'll see in there will be native species of milfoil, coontail or hornwort, and kara. And kara is actually a green algae that's encrusted in calcium that covers the shoal or the littoral zones of the most productive alkaline lakes. And that kara, which forms that heavy, dense carpeting on the bottom, is just home to so much aquatic food sources, whether invertebrates like freshwater shrimp and everything all the way up to leeches, damsels, dragons, cottonwood larvae, things like that. So a lot of it, just by looking at the lake, based on water, the aquatic vegetation in there will tell you whether it's alkaline or acidic.
Now, you said the tea stain. I know we have a private lake up here in Colorado, our property that we fish, and it is definitely, you know, tea stained. So you're saying if it's got that coloration, and it's got a lot of, I don't know what the name of the weeds are or the vegetation in it, but they're long, come up from the bottom, and it will fill, in fact, the lake in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
With that vegetation, it grows like just crazy.
Yeah.
So is that more of a neutral lake then?
Yeah, it's probably neutral water. When you get into neutral water, you can have both alkaline and acidic liking vegetation in it. so they kind of cross over there. But usually if you have tea-stained water, that's an indication that there's tannins and lignans in the water, which are often associated with neutral to acidic soils in the area, and that your predominant coniferous forest base there is probably spruce or a heavy pine, which would lend itself more towards the acidic side of things.
Right, right, which it is, yeah. Yeah, and this one has just very little inlet in it, very little outlet. It's a man-made lake, but... Okay, let's see. We've got Ralph in Parker, Colorado. How much does a change in the weather affect insect activity? Do you think that going from a low pressure to high pressure system causes greater insect activity and thereby greater fish feeding? Or is the opposite more correct?
I think in my experiences, if we're in a low pressure system and then moving to a high pressure system, that would stimulate more insect activity, just because there is an impact of air pressure that goes below the surface of the water, and that rising barometer typically brings in warmer air temperatures coming in, which are going to be more favorable to an insect that is going to emerge and pop out from the surface of the lake. However, you often see brief bursts of insect activity right before thunderstorms where the barometric pressure is just starting to crash, and maybe these insects know that they better get off while they can because it's not going to be good later on.
Don't the betas do that a lot?
Often, yes.
Because I know it's like I've been up on the Bighorn River in Montana, and just before it starts snowing, they come off like crazy sometimes.
That's right.
Yeah, and you're in the middle of a snowstorm, and the hatch is going on. You know.
I guess they figured it's now or never.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, Dennis in Lakeside, Arizona asks about the effect of overcast or rainy days affecting chironomid fishing. Does that affect anything? Or do the chironomids come off? Do the fish feed more on a rainy day or a clear day?
Well, I think what anglers need to understand the most is that the biggest overall impact as to whether an insect is going to emerge, an aquatic insect is going to emerge, is it's dictated by water temperature. Water temperature where the pupae or the nymphs are prior to their emergence rise or emergence swim through the water column. And so if everything's right down there, they're going to make their way up to the surface of the lake. They can't get to the surface of the lake, peek their heads out and say, nah, don't like it, going to go back down. And so, you know, once they're committed to the nymphal swim or pupal rise or pupal swim to the surface of the lake, they're committed. And, you know, certainly there's lots of evidence that's, you know, overcast days, rainy, cloudy days seem to be more conducive to Calabatus and Betis mayfly hatches in still waters. That's a real given. They seem to like those cloudy, less bright, sunny days, whereas chironomids or midges will come off in a blinding snowstorm. So it can work both ways. We can have phenomenal hatches of chironomids and caddis in bright, sunny days and cloudy, rainy days as well.
Okay. Now, we got Frank Wood in Norwalk, California, asks about the moon phase and whether it has an effect on the lake.
Well, certainly, I'm a believer that I don't want to be planning my week-long trip to a secret lake when it's a full moon. Many anglers believe, and I'm certainly one of them, that you know, during a full moon, you can see a lot of feeding, nocturnal feeding of trout, whatever they're eating, leeches or insects, forage fish. It doesn't matter that. Under the cover of a moonlit night, they seem to feed quite heavily. And so, you know, you always want to plan your fishing trip, you know, the week before a full moon, prior to a full moon, any time away from the start of a full moon.
So you think it's the light that keeps them?
At night, yeah, you get the light and they feed. They feed at night.
So they're more spooky because of they don't have the cover of darkness, basically.
That's right. That's right, yeah.
Okay. Let's see here. We've got John Kent, Fox Creek, Alberta, It says, when confronted with tough conditions brought on by an unstable barometer causing fish to seemingly develop lockjaw, I assume that's, yeah, not opening, what tactics do you use to combat this and ultimately increase your success rate? So, again, coming back to the barometer.
You know, with that rapidly dropping or a crashing barometer, you know, the fish do go off the bite, they go off the feed, and or go off actively feeding. And so you have to employ tactics like using a tractor-style patterns, irritate the fish into biting, and things like flashy, bright flies strip quickly through the water, things like, you know, booby patterns, bright orange, bright chartreuse green, will get the most dour of fish mad and get them chasing the fly. And I think you got to be prepared to fish sinking lines, prepared to cover a variety of depth zones, and probably increase the rate that you're going to be stripping your flies through the water, because you're trying to induce an aggressive strike versus an actively feeding strike.
And I suppose there's always breaking out the thermos and having that cup of coffee and sitting it out for a while, too.
Yes, there's that as well.
Okay, we need to take another quick break, and when we come back, we'll dig into this a bit more. Keeney's Fly Shop in Sacramento, California features classes on all aspects of fly fishing. They have an extensive inventory and fly tying department, and a friendly, experienced staff whose primary goal is your complete satisfaction. Among their many services, one can book private waters or take advantage of their international travel service. Visit their extensive website at www.keeney.com. That's K-I-E-N-E.com. K-I-E-N-E.com. Or you can call them at 1-800-400-0359. That's 800-400-0359. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Brian Chan about fly fishing trout lakes. If you'd like to ask Brian a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. But we did get, we have got a couple of questions here, Brian, on the Internet. And one kind of backtracks here, but it's Colin in Saskatoon asks, are there ways to increase oxygen level in eutrophic lake bodies of water? The winters here in Saskatchewan are long, and so the oxygen levels might be very low by the end of the winter. Also, what types of bodies of water are best for trout to successfully spawn in? So we got two questions there.
Yep, you can certainly aerate lakes during the winter months. But every lake is unique, and you have to make an individual assessment of each of those water bodies. And the water body has to have certain parameters, like it's got to be 20 to 25 feet deep in order for the aeration to be effective, because if you're aerating a very shallow, shallow pond, one of the drawbacks or negative impacts of aeration is that you supercool the water, and it really does impact invertebrate biodiversity in the lake, and it really slows down and alters emergence timing as well. And it impacts the growth rates of fish as well as the insects. Mind you, on the other side of the coin, it may be enough to keep the fish alive. But the bottom line is you can aerate, and there are numerous techniques of aeration out there, and you kind of match the type of aeration system to the exact water chemistry of the lake that you're dealing with. And I'm sorry, what was the second question, Roger?
He was asking, were there particular types of bodies of water that are better suited for spawning?
Well, if you're talking about trout in general, like rainbow trout or cutthroat trout, not char, brook trout, the rainbows, like, they are stream spawners. And that's always been an issue. If you have fish in a lake that doesn't have a natural stream, then the fish become egg-bound, and they can't successfully spawn, and there's mortality associated with that. So in the ideal situation, if you have reproductive trout in a lake, then you want to have some way for them to spawn, be it a natural stream that runs for part of the year, or you create an artificial spawning channel where you use an electric pump and pump water out of the lake up a channel, run it back down, fool the fish into thinking it's a natural creek, and they come up there and spawn and get rid of their eggs. And once they get rid of their eggs, then those fish will quickly clean up and then get back into the general population of fish that are catchable.
Now, so if we have a small lake that has really no significant inlet or outlet, no stream coming in, and it's been stocked with rainbows, then what you're saying is that those rainbows are basically will not spawn and are in essence sterile? Or
well, if they're a reproductive strain of fish, meaning they're two and they can spawn, that means, and there's no inlet or outlet, they're just going to cruise the shoreline looking for patches of gravel, looking for upwelling, some spring activity for them to try to spawn. And if they don't spawn, then the males and females become egg-bound, the males become milk-bound, and there is a significant mortality can be associated with those fish not being able to release their eggs.
So will they flat out not spawn at all? I mean,
they'll become egg-bound, and by egg-bound, I mean there's a window of time when the females can release their eggs, and then after that, the vent seals up on them, and those eggs are in the body cavity, and they reabsorb them. But it takes its toll on the survival of those fish that are trying to reabsorb.
But if they can successfully release their eggs, can the eggs and the fry successfully
survive? Yeah. If they do it over an upwelled area that's well oxygenated and the water temperature stays cool enough, yep, you can get reproduction, absolutely.
Okay, good. Okay, so that was that question. We had a question by David in Kelowna.
Kelowna.
Say it again?
Kelowna.
Kelowna, okay, British Columbia. And he's asking about, he said last year it was a tough year in his area, late ice off by almost a month, a really hot, dry summer, quick fall season, so basically a short summer there. And he says everything was off. Hatches were off. They were shorter, later. And just everything seemed to be off. And he's wondering if that's two parts of his question. Can you give any advice on how to fish these anomalies? And even if chironomids seem smaller and less this year, so is there any difference in your fishing other than kind of matching the hatch there?
Yeah, well, certainly, David experienced the same things. I would have said the same thing around in Kamloops, which we're probably fishing similar waters. It was a very challenging year, and I think the worst part of it was that we got extremely hot. We had a good old-fashioned interior summer where we were cooking hot for almost 2 months, and the water temperatures just cranked up, got quite hot, stayed warm, and really put the fish off. It did have an impact, it seemed, on certainly the duration of chironomid hatches. They were shorter just on a daily basis. They didn't hatch as long, and the overall duration of specific hatches were much shorter. Compounding those changes in climate or weather, a lot of lakes have been, in the southern interior of British Columbia, have been impacted by low water levels. And it's been an ongoing situation where we're not getting the winter snowpacks that we normally have had, and these lakes are basically drying up. And that's having a major impact on the survival of invertebrates, the available habitat not only for bugs but for trout as well, because the lakes get shallower and shallower. The shoal areas that used to be 6 to 8 feet deep are now only 3 or 4 feet deep, and they're not usable by fish in the summertime because it's too warm. So there's a lot going on, but certainly a lot going on last year on these lakes that made it more of a challenging year. I can honestly say personally that I probably fished leeches a lot more last year than I have normally done, and that's simply because if the bugs aren't hatching, you got to go back to food sources that are always available in there, like leeches and dragonflies, things like that, and try to get them to bite food sources like that. We're not certainly shaping up too great for a lot of snow this year. The snowpacks are really low again, so hopefully we're not going to endure the same situation as we did last year. Every year, no question, every year is different, and a combination of fluctuating water levels and how warm the summer gets, how warm the warm water above the thermocline establishes, really impacts on what fish are doing in the lake. And even though we might think they're not eating very much down there, you have to remember that there's a lot of zooplankton in our lakes, Daphnia, Cyclops, Bosmina, these little green and orange dots that you see swimming around in a glass of water that you take out of the lake. And the trout literally just have to open and close their mouth and filter these little organisms through their gills, and they can survive on that quite well.
Okay, okay. Question from Bob in Pennsylvania. Do you think fishing lakes in the east is the same as the west? Are there big differences?
That's a good question. I think the thing you have to remember, Bob, is that although the fishing might be, although the actual physical makeup of the lakes and the water chemistry may be different, if you have the same bugs in the lake, if you have the same midges or chironomids, and you have mayflies and damsels and dragons, they're going to hatch the same way they are in a lake in the eastern states as they are in lakes in the western states. And so if you use the techniques to mimic or imitate the different stages of life cycles, it doesn't matter where you are on the continent, they'll produce fish for you.
Okay. Scott, he's asking about recent rotenone,
yep.
In many provincial lakes, being provincial meaning, I guess, Canadian lakes, right, used to control illegally introduced invasive alien fish species, what might one expect to see as an average recovery time for the native aquatic insect life within those water bodies?
So what Scott's referring to is that the provincial Ministry of Environment has said we're going to deal with the illegal movement of spiny rayed fish. So the movement of fish like perch and bass and crappie, which are not native. And then when you put them into a lake that supports only trout, you basically destroy the trout fishery because the spiny rayed fish are so aggressive and they literally take over. So the province has been acting on it. They've been removing those illegally moved or transported fish populations. And it generally takes, rotenone is an organic piscicide that is non-selective. It kills any kill-breeding fish in the water. However, one benefit of rotenone, well, I guess call the benefit, is that you use light enough concentrations of it that you do have some impact on the macroinvertebrates like gammarus or scuds, shrimp, mayflies, damselflies, things like that. You don't totally wipe them out. And typically the ministry would leave a lake foul or poison the lake and then not reintroduce fish into it for 6 to 12 months. And during that fallow period, the insect or invertebrate populations will rebound at an amazing rate.
Okay, so basically they're killing all the fish in the lake and then
yep.
They'll come back and stock it later.
Restock it just with game fish, yeah.
Okay, okay. That's interesting. I didn't know that was going on. Tom in Delta, B.C., asked about pine beetle problem affecting lake fisheries. Does it?
Yeah, so what Tom's referring to is a massive outbreak of mountain pine beetle insect that has swept through the interior of the province of British Columbia and basically destroyed our lodgepole pine and to somewhat an extent the ponderosa pine in forests. They completely killed them all, and it's gone through Colorado and parts of Idaho.
Yeah, it's
well.
Terrible here.
And now for BC, we've gifted it to Alberta. So it's over there now.
Nice.
And it's because I know the population was always there, but our winters used to be cold. They were cold enough and that we would get extremely cold temperatures for 3 to 4 weeks in the winter months, and that would keep them in check. Well, we've lost those cold winters due to climate change, and now we've lost our pine forest, and it's had a significant effect or impact on small lake resources. And the biggest impact, if you think about it, is now we've got these huge forests of dead pine that many lakes sit in. And when those pine trees were alive, the root systems retained moisture, helped retain soil, the structure of the soil kept it intact. Now that they're all dead, what we're seeing is faster, shorter runoff, where the water just sweeps through and down through the dead pine forests, taking nutrients out of the soil with it and quickly flushing through or filling or partially filling and then going to the lakes. And so we're seeing nutrient loading into the lakes because those trees, now that they're dead, the roots aren't retaining anything in there, any of the nutrients themselves. And we're seeing, the forest canopy is changing. All those trees are dead. You know, we're getting more intense sunlight. We've lost forest vegetation right to the edges of the lakes, so you've lost you know, aquatic, or you lost insect and other animal life habitat around the edge of the lake. So there's been a significant impact.
Yeah, we have. It's incredible. Some areas of Colorado are just devastated. And,
yep.
Yeah, and we were wondering about that, too. We were up in an area called Summit County in Colorado where Breckenridge and all the ski areas are, and you just look around and everything's brown.
Yeah.
And I don't know that the tourists are really aware of what's happened there. But, yeah, you're thinking about the runoff this coming year is going to be incredibly bad because there's nothing holding it up there.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's move on to talk about fish. More specifically, we've got some questions about fish. The first one from Brian, must be your twin brother up there in BC, asks about what's the selection process when it comes to stocking certain lakes and not others. He's asking about something I don't know. You probably know what this is, an AF3N, evidently some kind of fish that usually grows considerably larger, he says, than other strains in a short amount of time, and why isn't it stocked in certain lakes and others?
Sure. So what AF3Ns are all female triploid rainbow trout or brook trout. So when I'm speaking on behalf of the Minchin environment or the way it was when I was the fishery biologist here, you have X amount, say you've got 200 lakes that you're managing in a region, and the ministry is trying to manage for a diversity of fishing experiences from user-friendly family fisheries to general fisheries to quality fisheries to trophy fisheries. And so, generally, as you step up the ladder from quality and trophy fisheries, you often have a suite of regulations that are in place so that you're going to get quality or trophy fish. And so that often means reduced creel or reduced limits or no limits. It's catch and release. And so you can use certain strains of fish. So an all-female 3N is a sterile fish. It's a sterile rainbow trout. And so you want to put those in lakes or fisheries where they're going to stay in the lake and grow and live a long time and grow big. But you don't want to be putting them into lakes where the harvest is going to be so high, you're not going to get the benefit out of taking the time and spending the money to produce those special stocks of fish. So the quality and the trophy lakes typically get the triploids or non-reproductive strains of rainbow trout. And that's because simply they're going to be in the lake longer because of reduced creel or catch and release regulations on the lake. And the more general family type fisheries are going to get the reproductive or diploid stockings of rainbow trout because they are going to be harvested at a much greater rate.
And it brings up another question for me. What controls the size of fish? Now, obviously, you just said, hey, if they live long enough, they're going to grow bigger, and we've got some trophy fish. But does the size of the lake control the size of the fish as well? Again, I'm thinking about this private lake that I fish a lot. And I've caught a lot of 18-inch, couple of 20s, but never anything bigger than that. Is the lake size itself restricting the fish?
Oh, yeah. That's a very good question, Roger, and I'm sure it'll be of interest to the audience. So, I mean, you've got a 100-acre lake, and it's quite nutrient-rich. Well, that 100-acre lake will produce X amount of 10-pounders or X amount of 1-pounders. There's a finite limitation. There's a finite limitation to what that lake can produce. So you can produce a smaller number of big fish or a large number of small fish. You can't have it both ways. And so biologists look at the water chemistry. They measure the area of shoal or littoral zone in the lake, the productive zone in the lake, and we use formulas to determine how many fish per hectare of shoal area we put into the lake to get certain sizes of fish that we want. We also factor in another important factor is a parameter called total dissolved solids of the water body. So it's the basically, the chemical makeup of that water body will determine if it plays a factor. There's a formula that you use as well. So the bottom line is you have to be very careful on the numbers of fish you stock into a lake in order to get the size of fish you want. You have to consider the regulations and the harvest. You take into consideration natural mortality, predation from birds, and you have to factor that all in before making the decision to put X amount of fish in the lake and the size of the fish that go in the lake. So you have to know the water body.
What happens in a wild lake?
In a wild lake, it's Mother Nature rules the roost. So in a wild lake, someone could say, well, geez, I fish wild lakes and there's 15 pounders in there. Well, that's because there's probably not very many fish in the lake in order to get them that big. And the reason why there are not very many is because they may be spawning in an outlet creek that goes for 100 feet and then falls off a cliff. And so there's only a limited amount of spawning. Or they're spawning in a creek, in an inlet creek, that gets plugged up with beavers every year. And so there's a very limited amount of natural recruitment coming back to the lake. Or they could be fishing a wild lake and it's full of 10 inches and they never get any bigger. Well, that's because there's lots of good spawning and they're overpopulated. And the only way you're going to get those fish bigger is to reduce the population. And you can reduce the population, you control the population by managing or limiting the amount of spawning. You can harvest fish, you can remove fish out of the lake to reduce the population as well.
We had a question here. I don't know if this is this person's name or where they're from or what medicine hat. But he says, he's talking again about the triploid trout having, do they really have a significantly faster growth rate than diploids? And is the life cycle of a triploid longer than a diploid?
So the interest in triploids is basically because they do grow fast. They can live quite a bit longer than a diploid or reproductive fish. So you can get some monstrous trout growing in double digits, well over 20 pounds in some situations. What we see in British Columbia in the provincial stocking program, and which is based on wild stocks, we see that triploid rainbow trout that we've triploided, for the first 2 years of their life cycle, grow slower than a regular or diploid rainbow trout. Same strain, same fish. Once diploid, once triploid. Once we get past 2 years of age, when they enter their third year, the diploid trout or the reproductive trout begin directing energy towards the development of eggs and milt, whereas the triploid trout just keep growing bigger and bigger. And that's when they surpass the growth rates of diploid trout, is after year two. So they need to stay in that lake for 3 and 4 years before you see the big differences, because for the first 2 years they're growing slower.
Yeah, interesting, because that's part of kind of the evolutionary process of for every give there's a take, right?
Yeah, that's right.
You can't have the best of everything.
Yeah.
You can't have a huge fish that's an excellent spawner. And,
yeah.
It just doesn't all go together. Right?
Yeah. And depending on the strain of fish that the question was also, do triploids live longer than diploids? Well, depending on the lineage of that fish, if they're wild fish versus a fish from a captive brood stock, the wild fish tend to live longer. We've got, I know of lakes with blackwater strain of rainbow trout that we've triploided that have lived for 9 and 10 years. So they're 9 and 10 years old. Being triploid, they would never live that. If they were diploids, they would have been dead after 5.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So the average age of a normal trout is about 5 years?
In a wild situation, 5 and 6 years old is getting, it's getting up there, yeah. There's always exceptions, but that's fairly common. The rigors of spawning takes their toll on the fish as well.
Sure, sure. Now, Kurt asks about, and I guess this is up near you too, why are trout typically smaller in the Vernon area lakes than in Kamloops?
Typically the lakes in the Vernon, Kelowna area are not as nutrient rich as compared to the ones around Kamloops. So the total dissolved solids, the TDS in the lakes around Kamloops is higher, the pH is higher, and they're just more productive. Even though you're going to see the same insects in them, the abundance of the insects is much greater in the lakes in and around Kamloops. You just got to drive that extra half hour. Sorry about that.
Okay, well, with that, time to take another quick break. And I have a question, a follow-up on the Kamloops rainbows that I'd like to ask. So hang tight. We'll be right back. Have you ever dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Did you know that it's possible for you to make your own bamboo fly rods? With the help of Power Fiber's online magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods and telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod-making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod-maker profiles to classic tapers, Power Fibers has it all. Visit our website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Brian Chan about fly fishing trout lakes. If you'd like to ask Brian a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Brian, Kamloops rainbows are world famous. Why, and what's so special about them, and why are they so special?
Well, what we coined the Kamloops trout is basically it is a wild native strain of rainbow trout that still lives in a number of lakes in and around the Kamloops, southern Okanagan area. They're the native trout they're insect eaters. They like to eat insects. The majority of lakes around the Kamloops area that support these rainbow trout, the only species of fish in these lakes, the only fish in these lakes are the trout, and there's no competitor non-game fish species in these waters, so they're what we call monocultures, just trout. So they're insect eaters, and they like, these fish are strong fighters, they like to jump, and we culture a lot of these interior rainbow trout, Kamloops trout, and put them into hundreds of lakes in the province, and we take those eggs each year from one particular lake called Penasque Lake, which is about halfway between Kamloops and Kelowna. That lake has a wild population of Kamloops rainbow trout that have been in there since whenever. It's never been stocked, and we go in each spring and take eggs from a small percentage of the population from the inlet spawning stream. That's how we keep the gene pool going there and maintain the strong fighting aspects of the fish that so many people enjoy in the lakes in British Columbia.
Interesting, interesting. Well, there sure are a lot of nice pictures of those rainbows that I see. They always seem to be fat and happy. So definitely is a good strain, obviously. Okay, we've got a question from Robert in Colorado Springs, Colorado. Very interesting question. Two questions. First, he says, I know that the lateral line on a fish is extremely important with its ability to detect pressure waves, like the ones a wading angler pushes out when wading. Does this become less of a concern when wading in rougher water, for instance, like riffles or versus the pool? So let's start with that. So are we disturbing more fish in a lake than we are in a riffled stream with that kind of pressure?
Well, because if you're in moving water, there's a lot more natural disturbance occurring, because the water's simply moving, things are tumbling along the bottom, and so our movement would in a riffle would be much more masked than if you're moving in a dead, very slow-moving pool of water and then once you get into a lake, it becomes different again as well.
Because you have the larger the lake, and it's all relative to how far away the fish are from you as well.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, and the second part of his question is, because a trout cannot change the diameter of their pupil, it has to move the light-sensitive component of each rod into a masking pigment. Person knows a bit about biology, it sounds like. For low-light conditions, does a trout sacrifice visual acuity and his ability to perceive colors? If so, do they rely more on sound or pressure when feeding at night?
I think it's fairly safe to say that as light levels drop, the fish are going to rely more and more on sound and changes in pressure that they pick up through their lateral line under low light and certainly at night.
Okay.
So it definitely, he's correct on that.
He's correct on that. Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay, so at night, more dealing with pressure, lateral line, and at day, more sight.
That's right. That's why when we're fishing at night in shallow water, because fish are in shallow water feeding, we're often using patterns like woolly bugger type patterns where a lot of hackle on the fly, a lot of pulsing movement that is sending little sound waves to the water that these fish can get orientated using their lateral line.
Okay, let's now move on and start talking about food and flies. And I'm going to kind of give people a heads up right now that we are not going to get through all the questions we have here tonight. Brian and I discussed this earlier. Let's put it this way, folks. We're at the end of page 3 on our questions, and we've got like 9 pages of questions. So I know a lot of you are waiting to get your questions answered, and you're going, hold it. These guys aren't going to get to my questions, and you're right. So what Brian and I agreed to do here is, because we didn't want to, you know, we didn't want to rush through this and just try for the sake of trying to cover everything in one night, just plow through it and not give, you know, the good quality answers that, that Brian's capable of giving. So what we've agreed to do here is we'll finish up here tonight because we're getting close already. And Brian's already agreed to do part 2 of Fly Fishing Trout Lakes, where we'll continue with the same group of questions and make sure we get all these answered. And so he's kindly, generously offered his time to do another show, and we've planned to do that on February 3rd, okay? So February 3rd, we'll be doing part 2. So that's the compromise, but we will, by doing that, be able to answer a lot more of these questions than trying to cram them in one night. So, anyway, with that said, let's try to get as many we can in tonight still, Brian, and see what we can do. So, food and flies. When Pat in Bountiful, Utah asks, when fishing in lakes for trout, is it best to try to imitate insects or bait fish for best results?
I think if you have a combination of, I think it doesn't matter whatever lake you go to, you have to try to figure out if there's insects hatching, then that would seem a logical choice to try to imitate that particular insect that's hatching. Or if you arrived at the lake and you saw fish, bait fish, busting, you know that someone down below is chasing them, and that would be your first clue that you want to perhaps try bait fish. Or if you got to the lake and you saw damselflies emerging or caddisflies being eaten off the surface, that would tell you that you probably want to try that particular insect first rather than going to bait fish. So it's going to depend on time of year and when you get to the lake, actually, to determine it.
And then also, like you had said earlier, if pressure zone has put the fish down or something, then you may want to go to an attractor pattern or something, which, you know, simulating bait fish.
That's right, yeah.
So you really have to, you just have to pay attention to what's going on in the lake and figure it out, right?
Your eyes are so important to be looking on the water, over the water, and in the water all the time to see what's happening. Just watching for birds. There may be a hatch going on in one end or what the other end of the bay you're in, and they're not hatching around you, and you'll only know that by, you know, using a pair of binoculars and glassing over there to see, well, why are all those swallows diving over there and there's none diving here? Well, I'd be pulling up anchor pretty quick and getting over and having a looky-loo.
Yeah. Now, this is kind of a follow-up. Robert in Idaho asks about how does one tell what the fish are eating at any given time during the year. I guess he's referring more to, you know, the hatches that occur during different times of year.
And, you know, again, just to follow up again, you look on the water, look on the edge of the lake before you even get on the water to look for cast insect shucks to see if there's been some mayflies hatching or there have been some chronomids or midges coming off. You know, you need to be able to identify them. You take into consideration the time of year. Is it early spring? Is it early summer? Is it late spring, midsummer? To get an idea of what should be hatching for that time of year for emergence timing. And that type of emergence, then you're always looking in the water. Say you catch a fish. If it's big enough, you can do a throat pump of the fish, sample its throat, and done properly, the fish, you can release the fish and unharmed. And that'll give you an idea of the last few food items that have gone, that fish has just about swallowed into his stomach.
Now, you brought up, and there's a question about, since you mentioned shucks, leftover shucks. Randy in Bend, Oregon asks, can you tell the color of a midge pupa from the leftover shuck? I guess he's trying to identify what color midge to use then, based upon the shucks.
The shucks give you some clues. Some species of chronomids, their shucks will give you a lot more clues. For instance, there's a chronomid, we call them carrot chronomids or amber chronomids, that come off on a lot of our local lakes. and the shock has a very distinct amber-brown outline to it. It's a dead giveaway that the color of the pupa was, you know, dark summer duck or amber color in coloration. Oftentimes, the shock are more translucent and more difficult to determine color. That's when you capture the adults and take a look at the abdominal color of the adult, and you can work backwards to figure out what color the pupa was.
Okay. Sally Sheets in Manitou Springs, Colorado asks, Brian, how important is the larva versus the pupa stage of chironomid in a trout's diet in still waters?
Well, basically, the trout eat both the larval and the pupa stage. Trout have to look a little harder for the larva because they often are still in their larval tubes at the bottom lake, so the trout literally have to seek them out and suck them out of their larval tubes. So a little bit more work involved versus the pupa, who congregate and stage at the bottom of the lake, suspended in the water column, getting ready to rise through the water. They're sitting ducks. And so trout love to eat the larva early in the spring and late in the fall, but when there are pupa around, they're a lot easier food source. For trout, it's all, for any animal, it's all about how much energy they have to expend to get the greatest benefit. And for animals and trout, and they want to spend the least amount of energy for maximum amount of food because they don't want to be exposing themselves, swimming all over the lake and exposing themselves to predators. So it's a lot easier to eat the chironomid pupa than have to go looking for and poking through the mud to get the chironomid larva.
Okay. Now, Rob, in, it says Lower Mainland, B.C., he says, when fishing chironomids, do you try to match size and color configuration exactly, or do you like to go a size up to stand out among the thousands?
You know, obviously, size and color is important. Probably color, you know, if you had to rank the two, I think, you know, oftentimes color is just a notch higher than the size. What I like to do at the start of a hatch, if I'm out, it's the third week of May when there's chironomids coming off, I can see they're brown. I'll typically throw, if it's early in the day, I'll throw a bigger pupa out than what's actually emerging. It's just, you know, they're not picky yet. It's a great, well, they're going to see this great big one drifting down through the water column. They'll come up and grab it. But as they start feeding more and more actively on the pupa of the day, you have to start refining your size to get closer to the real ones that are coming off. So bottom line, in my mind, you can use bigger flies, bigger imitations of the pupa, and bigger imitations that may not be exactly the exact coloration, but you'll get away with it early in the hatch of the day. But as they get feeding intensely on those bugs, you got to start refining it.
Okay. Larry in New Mexico asks, why are the chironomids in still waters so much larger than in the tailwaters below? Aren't they the same bugs, he asks?
They're probably different. There will be populations of chironomid species that live just in the tailwater versus what's in the lake above. And there will be pupa that come down through the tail to the dam and then enter the, and that, so they'll be the same ones. But the basic reason why the chironomids are bigger in the tailwaters above, or pardon me, in the lake above the tailwater, is that they're living in a static environment that is more stable environment, not worrying about getting swept away by current, and in fact may have more steady, warmer water temperatures at the bottom, and so that their environment is more stable, and they have a readily available food source. They don't have to go looking for it, so they expend less energy looking for their food as well.
All right. Well, Brian, unfortunately, we've run out of time here tonight. I know a lot of people are going to be disappointed that we didn't get into a lot of the other questions, but we're doing the best we can. So we're just going to have to continue on part two on February 3rd, folks, and join us then, and we'll get into more of the strategies and tactics and equipment and more about flies and food and so forth. There's just so much to talk about. So please bear with us and stick with us, and we'll have another great show then. But for now, we've got to wind things up. Stay tuned here. We're going to be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine, and we're also going to be giving away a copy of Brian's DVD, Expert Techniques for Stillwater Fly Fishing with Brian Chan. Just as Lance Armstrong says, live strong, there's a fly fishing organization that's helping women battle cancer to fish on. It's Reeling and Healing Midwest. Reeling and Healing Midwest is a nonprofit organization that champions fly fishing retreats for women surviving and battling all types of cancer. Their mission is to introduce women to the healing powers of the sport of fly fishing and provide a one-of-a-kind experience on and off the water. This is accomplished through the elements of fly fishing, positive camaraderie, peer coaching, nature and support network, which in turn renews the spirit and hope of each participant. Reeling and Healing Midwest is in need of trout, flies, waders, leaders, fishing equipment, and other items. To view their current wish list and to learn how you can support their retreats, visit www.reelingandhealingmidwest.org. That's reelingandhealingmidwest.org. Or call 866-237-5725. That's 866-237-5725. Well, just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section on tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on the link and leave your comments. Well, now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners of our drawings are randomly selected from this show's registration database, and if you didn't register for tonight's show yet, it's a little late now, but catch us next time. We're always giving away some great prizes, and get into the registration database so you have a chance to win. So we'll do our drawings here, and the first one is going to be for a one-year membership for the Federation of Fly Fishers, which is always a great organization to support and be part of. And if you want to learn more about the Federation and don't know about them, go to www.fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org. And so our winner there is David Gonzalez, I guess it is, in Arizona. So, David, you're the winner of that one-year membership. If you're already a member, we'll get it extended for you. If not, enjoy. You'll get a lot out of that membership. And now we're going to give away a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. And this is a magazine out of Calgary, Canada. Great, great, wonderful publication. And our winner there is Don Reibergard, and he's in California. So congratulations, Don, on winning that one-year subscription to Fly Fusion. So, that takes care of our drawings, and now we need to come up with a winner here for our giveaway of the DVD, of Brian's DVD, and we have to clear my queue here, and okay, so the question here is, and I'll make this one pretty easy, which stage of the chironomid is easier for the trout to feed on in still water? Which stage of the chironomid is easier to feed on in still water? So, Brian, that's pretty easy, right?
Yeah, it should be.
Yeah, and looks like we got a winner here. He says pupa, Brian, is that it?
That's right on.
Right on, so we got one right out of the chutes. Got it on the first pass here, and that's Jeff Wargan in Los Angeles, California. So, Jeff, congratulations. Now, Jeff, what you're going to want to do is send me your name, mailing address, email address, phone number, and so forth, your contact information. You can do it in the same box. You just answer the question, or you can send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com. That's info@askaboutflyfishing.com, and then we'll get Brian to mail that DVD off to you, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it and learn a lot from it. If others want to get that DVD, can they just go to your website then, Brian?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Okay. So, and the website is, again?
www.riseformflyfishing.com.
Great. Well, congratulations, Jeff, and anyone else, if you want to look at that DVD, you can get it at Brian's website. Well, Brian, hey, thanks for being with us tonight. It was a pleasure. Again, we had so much to talk about. People have a real interest in what you have to say. So I'm glad you've already agreed to join us on February 3rd, and we'll regroup, and we'll attack this again.
Yep, I look forward to continuing the discussions with you, Roger.
Great, terrific. Well, our next broadcast in between will be next week on January 20th at 7 p.m. Mountain and 9 p.m. Eastern. And on that show, we're going to be interviewing Rick Hartman, and our topic for the show will be Rousting Redfish in Texas. Rick Hartman is an expert sightcaster, and having guided for redfish on the flats of southeast Texas for over 10 years, knows how to hook up with the big ones. Rick's secrets on hooking up with big redfish on a fly could make your next trip to the flats a real memorable one. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Royal Gorge Anglers, Keeney's Fly Shop, and Power Fibers Online Magazine for sponsoring our show tonight. If you'd think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-888-961-1115 extension 2. That's 888-961-1115 extension 2, and we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.